Welcome to Grant. You're listening to Off the Wall on Swimming World Radio. Here are your hosts, Nathan and Felipe.
Welcome, one and all, to another episode of Off the Wall on Swimming World Radio. I'm your host, Nathan Jendrick, joined by Felipe Delgado. We've got lots to talk about on the show today. Lots happening in the world of swimming. Lots of it going on in the mainstream, and we'll discuss if that's good or bad for our sport. And then later on in the swim-off one-on-one interview, we'll be playing our first part of an interview with Chloe Sutton, 2008 and 2012 Olympian. And that's going to be a great conversation. I think there's a lot that people don't know about Chloe that they'll probably find quite interesting. And as a 2008 open water Olympian and 2012 pool Olympian, she certainly has a unique perspective on our sport, and Chloe's just a fantastic person in the pool and out. So looking forward to speaking with her. Felipe, first up, we are now a couple weeks removed from the swimming portion of the Olympic Games, but lots going on in the sport, lots in the mainstream media, but I don't know that all of it necessarily makes our sport look so good.
This is the post Olympic hangover time for our sports, and a lot of athletes, as I heard this morning on a popular radio show, a lot of our athletes will milk the 15 minutes of fame that they get until the next Olympic Games comes around. Hopefully not. Hopefully this time it's a little bit longer with some of the athletes that we have headlining. But yes, we're looking at some mainstream shows and some daytime talk shows and TMZ and everything else that's out there nowadays.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I saw, and we'll start here, is on far as the mainstream things go, that we're just kind of flipping a coin on whether it's positive or not, is Olympic tattoos. For whatever reason, this time, and I haven't seen it as far as I could recall in 2000, 2004, or 2008, which are the three Olympics that I've paid attention to in my life, I've never seen an article before on athletes getting the Olympic rings as if it's a big deal. Now suddenly, I even logged on to MSN.com the other day, and the headline was Missy Franklin got a tattoo on her hip, and somehow this is mainstream news. I mean, I guess it's cool that the swimmers are being paid attention to, but am I the only one who's wondering why in the world that matters?
I think it has a lot to do with how easy it is to follow these swimmers nowadays. You know, a while back, 4 years ago, 8 years ago, if you think about, maybe a Jason Lezak or 8 years ago, Gary Hall Jr. or something like that, they went out and got tattoos after the Olympic Games. Not a lot of people would hear about it because it wasn't as easy to follow as it is now. Now, a personality, an athlete, a movie star goes out and drinks a latte or gets a tattoo or, whatever it may be. Everybody finds out about it because of social media. So it's a lot easier for people to follow and find out.
Right, but again, why does it matter? I mean, that's the part that I don't get. People get tattoos, and that's fine. This is a meaningful one, and that's great. But they're pretty innocuous. I mean, and Nick Thoman got his, I think, on his back, on his right shoulder or whatnot. Missy Franklin got hers on her hip. I mean, it's not like they got these things tattooed on their face. So who cares if somebody goes out and gets a tattoo of the Olympic rings? I don't know. I guess, like I said, it's good to see swimmers getting some coverage, but this just seems like the majority of people are going to see it and think, wow, is swimming so boring that we have to talk about tattoos? Like, what's going on? I think there's so much more to the sport that we could be talking about than what size of the Olympic rings the athletes got put on their body.
And I think that has a little bit to do with representation, who's representing our athletes and what they're putting out in front of the media, what they're putting out in front of their audience, because if there was a little bit better representation, I think that the right things would be put out in front of the media. You know, some of these athletes are wonderful people. I'm sure Missy Franklin went back to Aurora, Colorado, which is where she's from. I'm sure she went back and she may have done some philanthropic work with the city that she's from because of their unfortunate incidences that have taken place there recently. I haven't heard anything about that. We're hoping, and I would guess that she did do something of that nature when she did go back, because I think she had mentioned something like that before she left the Olympic Games. But you know what? If tattoos is what grabs the audience's attention, so be it. At least we stay in the news for a little bit longer than last time.
I suppose. I don't know. I mean, it's neat, and my wife has an Olympic rings tattoo, and I think it's just one of many that is meaningful to the people who got them. But I don't know that the rest of us necessarily need to know about it. I don't know, what about you, Felipe? You got your Olympic rings tattoo?
I do not, and I'm quickly closing in on 40, and I don't know if this is the right time for me to do it. So that time might have passed for me.
No, I think I think you still got time. Just get the, real big across your back, shoulder to shoulder. Better yet, put it on your forehead, man. I think that'll get you some media, at least.
From who? From our radio show? Maybe that's the only media that would cover that. But
well, that's fine. I'll tweet it for you. I think I've got I created a Twitter and I don't use it, but I still think I have like 20 followers. So somebody will see it, man. If you want some coverage, I'll help you
that's
out.
That's kind of cool. Maybe 20 yeah. people see it. No, you know what? I'm gonna let the young folk take care of the tattoos and all that stuff. I've got 3 daughters now. I don't want to be a bad example for my kids. Hold on a second.
I was going to put you on blast here.
Listen, I'm old school, but not that that's a bad, that's a bad influence if someone goes out and gets a tattoo. Listen, I've got brothers who have tattoos. But I don't know. I guess I'm just a little bit more old school. If I decided to someday go out and do it, who knows? Who knows? Maybe I'd do it and tell them why I did it, give them a reason. But you know what? We'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
My thing on tattoos is people say, oh, well, what are you going to think about your tattoo when you're 80? You know what? I'm not going to be – I don't think I'm going to be poolside without my shirt on when I'm 80, so I don't know that I really care at that point.
Hey, if I'm thinking anything when I'm 80, I'll be happy.
Exactly. Well, anyway, I guess it's good that it's out there, but it seems like there's a lot more good stuff that we could be talking about with our Olympians and their tattoos, but so be it. But another one of those things being discussed is Michael Phelps transitioning to golf. He's going to be on a reality show trying to improve his game. Lots of people are debating on whether or not this is going to be a successful transition for him. I know in the past, Ed Moses retired after 2004, not making the team for Athens, got in some golf, didn't make the PGA Tour, but from what I understand, he had some pretty good success playing amateur golf. I don't know. To me, I think when you are an elite level athlete, you have a knack for sports, but I don't know, Felipe, that there's a whole lot of similarities between swimming and golf other than the fact that a lot of swimmers like to golf.
A lot of athletes like to golf, so it shouldn't be a surprise that Michael is going to go do something that is more relaxing than swimming, quite possibly. Mentally, I don't think so. I think mentally, golf is probably the most mentally driven game that there is. I think that he needs to get away from the pool. He needs to do something that's going to relax him, that he's going to enjoy. We're all competitors, and being a 20-something-year-old competitor, owner of 18 Olympic gold medals, I'm going to guess that he's going to hold himself to the same standards that he held himself in swimming, and I think that's where the downfall comes for a lot of these professional athletes. I mean, if we don't have to look too far back, Michael Jordan did something similar to this. And when he realized that he was not Michael Jordan on the diamond, and when he realized that he was not Michael Jordan on the golf course, he quickly came back to the place that he felt more comfortable on the hardwood. So hopefully.
So do you think that Phelps taking up golf might be what ultimately leads him back to the pool? Because there's a lot of speculation from people that we're still going to see Phelps in Rio, even though he swears up and down that's not the case.
Now, the only thing is, I hate for him to do this because the sport, he has given a lot to the sport, and the sport's given a lot to him. But I think he should be a little bit more humble in his approach and saying, I love the sport of swimming. It's done so much for me. It's time for me to just kind of step back and, take a look at, where my true passions lay now or whatever it may be, instead of saying, no, I'm done with this. I'm done with this sport. I'm done with this. No way you're going to see me back. No way, Mom. We're not going to Rio. I'll fly you out to Rio. No, just a little bit more, being a little bit more humble may have gotten more people to like the fact that he was maybe stepping back, because it gives people hope that he may come back to the sport. The way he's putting it right now is, I'm never coming back. And I don't know, from the athletes that we've seen, Nathan, both you and I, we've seen a lot of unbelievable athletes retire and unretire, unbelievable athletes retire just to do something else that they feel they might have a temporary passion for. But ultimately, when you've done something for so long, this is the passion that burns within. And it's a passion that may be laying dormant with Michael right now, but ultimately when he realizes that he's not quite as good at other things as he was at this sport, he'll come back and maybe there'll be a completely newfound appreciation for the sport.
But the question is he going to want to? I mean, yes, there's a passion. Clearly he wouldn't have accomplished what he has if he didn't have a passion for the sport. But, you know, you mentioned, well, he's going to find he's not as good at other things. Well, that's fine, because I think everyone has something in their life that they can do better than anything else that they've got going on. And for him, that was swimming. And he did it better than anyone else has ever done it. But most of the athletes you talk about who retire and unretire, they feel like they have something left to prove. Brendan Hansen's a great example. Didn't like the way that he went out after Beijing. Decided, you know what, I have more to give. I'm coming back. And he did well, capturing a bronze medal individually. He did exceptionally well, and he felt like he had something to prove, and he was able to come back and do that. But when you're Michael Phelps, when you have 22 Olympic medals, when you have 18 gold medals, you have done so many things that nobody else has ever done, and things that likely no one else will ever do again. So he's in the unique position of feeling that, in the unique position that there is nothing left for him to prove. He said he's accomplished every goal that he's set for himself. So maybe he'll go golf and decide, nah, I'm not nearly as good as golf. But the question is he going to care?
Well, there's always that 19th gold medal. There's always being able to four-peat. Michael Jordan won 6 NBA titles, a ton of NBA Finals MVP, regular league MVP. Why did he come back? Why? Because he's the ultimate competitor. And he felt that he could not compete at the same level at his other ventures, which were true. He's on a venture right now that I can tell you this. If Michael Jordan wasn't approaching 50, I think he might be close to being 50, but he wasn't approaching 50. He would leave ownership so quickly to get back on that hard court. The fact that he doesn't do it is because he can no longer do it. So I think that goes a long way in saying that Michael, while he can do it, he may need a little bit of a break to realize that this sport offered him so much the same way that he offered the sport so much. And I think that the question may also be how much attention does he crave? Right now he has the life of an A-list movie star. What happens when that slips down to B-list or C-list or D-list? How much of that attention does he really crave? Maybe he comes back and does it for that. Maybe he comes back and does it for the glory of winning X amount of gold medals, or just to say, you know what, I'm competitive. I wonder if I can still do it. Let's remember Mark Spitz in the early 90s tried to come back, right, and had the duel in the pools versus Jaeger and Biondi, and we all know how that ended up. But I don't see Michael Phelps in the same category. I think Michael Phelps can take a few years off, come back, and probably do pretty well.
Well, physically, there's no doubt about it. Physiologically, he'll be stronger than ever if he decided to come back in 2016. But I don't see that. I know that a lot of people think that there's a variety of reasons why he would want to come back. I just don't see it happening. I have known Michael a little bit for quite a while. I've never seen him as the type of person who desired attention. He wasn't – I never got the impression that signing autographs was his favorite thing. I never got the impression that he actually enjoyed doing interviews. Those aren't the traits of somebody who you get the impression is going to want to come back just to relive those things. There are certain athletes that jump in front of a camera every chance they get. Those are the types of athletes that I think there's a precedent for. Hey, they're going away now, but don't worry, they'll be back when their star fades, and it's because they got to try to relive some magic. I don't see that being his personality. It's possible, but I think that he's going to finally enjoy not being the best at something. I know it sounds probably a little counterintuitive, but I think Michael's the type of guy who, when it comes to swimming, he knows he has the potential to be the best in the world, and that drives that competitive fire that makes him want to do it, and he has to do what it takes to be the best in that case. And now I think he's going to look at golf. Hey, the best golfers in the world started golfing when they were 3-4 years old. I'm just picking up golf in the last couple of years. This isn't something that I'm not going to go out and win the Masters. So I think for him, that takes some pressure off and will let him enjoy playing the game and enjoy a sport that doesn't involve 6 hours of training a day, 7 days a week. And I could be wrong, but I've got a pretty good feeling that Rio de Janeiro will be the first Olympic Games in a while that does not have Phelps involved.
You may be right. Time for somebody else to step up.
Yeah, I mean, I got a feeling. It sounds like we're going to see Lochte through like 2024.
Well, okay, so let's move on.
That guy just loves racing. I mean, you know, he says he's all about racing. And he just wants to keep competing as long as possible. And he's the type of guy that you don't get the impression that he's getting tired of it at all. So
I think he's just having fun.
Yeah, I mean, he's out there enjoying it. And now he says he's going to be heading out of Florida, moving to the L.A. area to pursue some things outside of the pool, which that might
Please, brother, don't do that.
You don't want to see Lochte take it to California?
No, brother, please. No.
Why don't you want to see him in your neck of the woods down there in Southern California?
It has nothing to do with his looks, because, man, that guy is handsome. It has nothing to do with his looks. If we were at a bar together, I'd be on one side of the bar. I'd make sure he was on the complete opposite end of the bar. Because, you know, nothing good can happen with me standing next to him. But let's just wait, and we can comment on that once that cameo on 90210 comes out. I saw the trailer, brother.
That I've not seen. Well, I'll have to Google that.
Nathan,
but
Nathan, I saw the trailer.
You don't sound like you were thrilled with it.
Just stay in Florida, brother. Just look, the World Wide Web is a friendly place. I mean, we can link. It's a global thing. You can link yourself up from Florida. Just don't go to Hollywood and get that temptation of Hollywood. And maybe some managers who tell you that you're great at acting because you are a great swimmer. And hopefully you'll be a good businessman too. But at acting, at this point, I'm not convinced.
Well, on the note of Lochte acting, there's a little bit of humor video out there with Lochte that folks might have seen. He did a couple of clips for Will Ferrell's funnyordie.com, which I think is a great website. Hilarious, has been since it launched, I believe, a couple of years ago now. It's put out some brilliant stuff. But Lochte's videos, his pee in the pool video, and then he did another video with Sir Patrick Stewart of Jean-Luc Picard's Star Trek fame. I'm not impressed with either of them, to be honest with you. I didn't find much humor in either piece, personally.
Okay. As far as that Funny or Die video, I thought it was great because I showed it to my 10-year-old, and she thought it was hilarious. So I got that excitement from watching her watch, you know, Ryan Lochte, and she thinks he's great. And watching him, and she really thought it was funny because, you know, that's for 10-year-olds. That's a big thing, you know, the whole peeing in the pool.
Yeah, for a 10-year-old. But how about for this near 40-year-old that is her father? What does he think?
I thought it was funny. I thought it was funny. I thought it was vanilla. I thought it was cool. You know, it was fine. It was fine. It's fine because, you know, I direct a team full of kids, and you can put that on a website, and all the kids can go and watch it, and they're talking about it the next day. You know, that's why I think it was funny. Was it funny? Was it my humor? Nah, not really. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was good.
Now, what about his video with Patrick Stewart? And although he had a much smaller part in that one, still didn't tickle my funny bone.
Listen, the only acting that he's going to be able to do is if they bring back Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and he does a
That's a great movie, by the way. Just throwing that out there.
He can pull off a reincarnation of Spicoli. Man. I think that.
Who's going to play Phoebe Cates, though? That's who's taking her spot. That's the question.
And who knows? Who knows? I'll leave that for the agents and casting directors over in Hollywood. But
do a swimming version of Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and you got to start thinking about who's going to play what, and that would be a very important role to fill.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, on another note of Lochte, in fact, I'd be interested to hear what some of our listeners think. If you all want to comment on the show on there on swimmingworldmagazine.com, find the show. And comment in the comments section. Let us know what you think about the Funny or Die videos starring Ryan Lochte. On another Lochte-esque note, though, saw a headline. Again, another one of those things that I'm just still kind of getting used to going to Yahoo or MSN and seeing swimming-related headlines. Apparently, Lochte is going to be trademarking Jia. And I don't think from the discussions that I've had that I'm the only one that wonders what in the world makes him think he actually needs to trademark that.
I don't know what you want me to say.
I don't get it.
You know, whatever. I'm old, bro.
I mean, I'm old. People trademark things that they are worried about losing. He's been using this for years. He's been a big deal for years. Obviously, more so now in mainstream than he has been. But I don't see anybody stealing "yeah." In fact, I'm not even sure exactly what part of speech it's supposed to go into. So I'm not sure that anybody would know what to do with it if they tried to steal it. So trademarking, I don't know. Maybe this is just one of those things that because swimming's getting headlines at the moment, it's just one of those things. He says, hey, let's do this. It'll be in the paper tomorrow. I don't know. I mean, what's the value of trademarking
this? Well, don't be so quick to say that nobody would try to battle him on trademarking. Yeah, there was a rapper, MC8. It's a rapper out of the 90s who came out to claim that that phrase was his. So we see a company that we're holding with this phrase, right? A rapper, MC8. I know you've heard of him, Nathan. I know you are a huge rap hip-hop follower. So MC8 from the 90s. You know who that is. And he came out and said, right. No, Ryan Lochte, this is mine. I've trademarked this. Now they're going to have a battle for yeah, right? So who knows? I mean, are we really talking about this? Is that important?
Hey, man, this is in the media. This is what we do on this show. We talk about what's hot and what's not. And apparently this is front page news. I mean, we're not even making this up. I'm telling you, MSNBC or whatever site I was on, headline, Lochte's face with a grill, might I add,
yep.
And trademarking yeah. I don't know.
Lochte does something. I guess, you know, it's also, it could, like, I'm going to go back to this again. It could be my age. Dude, and Nathan, when you talk to me, do I sound like I'm getting old? Do I sound like your parents?
Do you really want me to answer that? Okay. No, I'm kidding.
No, don't answer that. But there's some stuff that he's doing that might be, like, his generation that has passed me up because, you know, I'm older than he is. But it's like that, yeah, the grill, the pink swimsuit, the pink Speedo at Vegas pool parties. I don't know if you saw that.
No, I didn't see that. Although I actually was wondering why so many guys were wearing pink suits at trials. Did you notice that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't understand that either. I mean, more power to them. It was a very bright color that we normally don't see behind the block.
he had the pink Speedo on at a Vegas pool party. And it's just like, Ryan, you're so cool. There's some things I have to question, though, if they continue to be cool because you're doing them, because I think you're really walking the line of being, you know, I don't know, cool and not cool. I don't know what it is. I don't even know. Look, I'm not cool, so who am I to speak?
Well, I think one of the most endearing qualities about Ryan, though, is the fact that he doesn't care if he's cool. He does whatever is comfortable for him. And I think a lot of that is why people kind of find themselves flocking to Ryan, because it's like high school. You know, I mean, they're the kids who think they're cool that everyone else just runs around thinking, hey, that guy's a jerk. And then they're the guys who are just comfortable with who they are. They got a big group of friends. Maybe they're not all considered the most popular kids in school, but they're comfortable with what they do. They're comfortable with who they are, and that's why they have the friends that they do. And I think Ryan is just kind of an extension of that. You know, he likes having wings on his shoes. He likes having bright green shoes that only he would wear. He likes apparently wearing pink swimsuits to maybe to get some attention, or maybe just to show he doesn't care, or because he's Ryan Lochte and he can. I don't know. But, you know, it's one of those things that – maybe it's going to wear off in time. Personally, I'm not a fan of the grill, but I'm a fan of the fact that Ryan does it and clearly does it because he likes it, not because he feels like he needs the attention. You know, if that's his style, if that's what he wants to go with, man, more power to him. I think the world would be a much better place if everyone did what was comfortable to them and didn't care what other people thought. Obviously, celebrities are a little different. But I really do think that the fact that he doesn't care is one of the reasons why he's a celebrity in the first place.
Well, good. And, you know, individualism is great. I think it'll keep – maybe with some of these things that he's doing, it'll keep him in the limelight between races. And that'll be good because then, as you know, once he gets in the pool, he lets the racing take care of everything for him.
Yeah, yeah. And clearly he does it very well. So
yeah, exactly.
So can't fault him with that. I just think, you know, he's comfortable with who he is and what he does, and it allows him to focus on his swimming. And being comfortable, it certainly is going to make you a faster swimmer. So
that's correct.
More power to him. And if he needs to pee in the pool or trademark jaw or whatever, hey, you know, yeah. Who are we to argue?
Yeah, you know what? Hey, it could be masterful marketing, right?
Hey, that's right. I mean, he is getting headlines.
We're talking about
it. We may not
it.
Understand them, but he's getting headlines.
We're talking about it. TMZ's talking yeah. about it. Yahoo's talking about it. MSNBC's talking about it. So it could be masterful marketing on his part, and good for him if that's the case, because I don't get it, but guess what? I'm intrigued by it.
And, yep. And here we are talking about it on the show.
Exactly.
So, I mean, it's all coming full circle.
Awesome.
So, on a more serious note, before we get to our swim-off one-on-one interview with Chloe Sutton, I want to talk, because this wouldn't be a complete show if we didn't. We got a couple things to talk about based in, drumroll, China. It's been a topic over the last few shows, something to do with China, more particularly Yi Shiwen. But this time, it's going to have less to do with her performance, or I should say amazing performances from the London Olympics, but instead some comments that she made that are eerily familiar. And Felipe, I don't think that it helps their cause at all, but she more or less came out, and of course when it's translation, you don't want to say it's verbatim, but it was translated as her saying that China did so well because they train harder and that people are only suspicious because we're jealous. I mean, I was 10 years old in 1994, but you're talking about getting old, Felipe. You might remember this, but that sounds a little familiar, doesn't it?
It does. I was part of that World Championships in 94. I did go to Rome, and I did encounter some of these women or some of these Chinese swimmers that were closer to being men than women. I mean, it was pretty unbelievable. And I distinctly remember, what are we now, 18 years later?
Yeah.
I distinctly remember the comment was, "We train harder than you do." And that's pretty much exactly what she's saying now. So who knows? Who knows who's coaching them on what to say? But you know what? I'm not going to step into anybody else's category and say that she has done anything wrong, because she has not done anything wrong. And if that's – you know what?
Well, we don't know if she has, just like we don't know about any other swimmer.
That's correct. That's correct. And but I think I still fall under the innocent until proven guilty. And she's innocent as far as I'm concerned until, you know, someone says otherwise. And look, if she's being coached, all of that stuff usually works itself out. So ultimately, if she's being coached or if there's something going on that shouldn't be going on, ultimately it all works itself out. But until then, I think it's just some of the comments that she's saying. They just pose an eerily similarities to what was said in 94.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not of the comfortable mindset that things more often than not work themselves out. I think, unfortunately, we are in a sporting landscape where more people get away with cheating than get caught for it. So, I'm not going to go the same way. My same position I've been since she destroyed that 400 IM world record. I'm not saying that she's done anything wrong, because nobody can prove it, and it's wrong to say that's the case, a la John Leonard.
I don't want to ever be put in the same category with John Leonard. I mean, after...
Exactly, so. And I'm with you on that. That's why, you know, I had written a column on swimmingworldmagazine.com about suspicion's good. You need to be suspicious of otherworldly performances, because otherwise there's no point in drug testing at all, because if we're all supposed to just accept everything that we see, then there's no point in trying to find out who's doing it the right way and who's not. But, as I said then, and I agree with now, it's not okay to accuse people when you don't know. But in her comments saying, "Well, we train harder," it's baseless. It's too familiar to what happened in 1994. We know how that turned out. Those who forget the past, as they say, doomed to repeat it. It just, you know, it just, you got to be uncomfortable when you see so many things similar coming back up. I mean, everyone gave them a second chance, in 1998, right? And what happened there? And now here we are later on. And when you see things like, oh, well, China takes kids away, and I mean, just like we talked about last show,
right.
You know, all these things together, it's uncomfortable, particularly, I think, for Western cultures. And that's not to say that China's doing anything wrong as far as, you know, drug programs and whatnot these days. But when they've got the history that they've got on, you know, the physical development level as far as, you know, testing kids, taking them away, the problems they've had with drugs in the past, and now she's even saying things that they had said back then. So it's just, it's uncomfortable. I'd like to be able to say that those who train harder always win, but that's not necessarily the case. And the reason why I say that is because we've seen athletes like Gary Hall Jr., Jason Lezak, for example, two guys who swam significantly less volume than their competitors in many cases, and yet who more often than not came out on top in the vast majority of their races. It's not necessarily about training harder. It's about training smarter.
You know, I just – I have a tough time commenting on it simply because I'm not there. I don't know exactly what's going on. And you're right. The whole training smarter and not harder goes a long way. And I think you made a great point by pointing out Jason and Gary. But, you know, I think both of them had spectacular moments in their stellar careers at different times. And whether Gary was more of a competitor or Gary stepped up more, you know what? As far as I'm concerned, I'm friends with both of them, but as far as I'm concerned, the one that will stick out in people's mind is the guy, because people don't usually know his name, the guy who anchored the 4x100 freestyle relay for the Americans in 2008. So, but as far as, you know, who knows?
Right, I'm not talking about them necessarily against each other.
No,
I'm
right,
saying
right. No, I understand.
Their large volume of work combined, these are two guys who trained less than their competitors, but usually beat their competitors.
That's correct. And you know, they had completely different ways of training, and some natural talent had to be involved. But who says, and again, you might go back to stature and all of that good stuff, but who says that she doesn't have natural talent, or who says that her progressions aren't normal? I saw somewhere, and I'm not going to quote it because I don't remember where I saw it, but I saw somewhere that one of the swimmers that did well in 2012 also came to her defense and said, wait a second, what she did wasn't necessarily out of the ordinary, you know.
And that's what I've never understood. There's lots of people say, well, it's not out of the ordinary. Anytime you break a world record that was set in a tech suit and you break it in a textile suit by 3 seconds, there's nothing to compare this to. Of course it's abnormal. Well, that doesn't mean that it's tainted, but of course it's abnormal.
Well, anytime you break a world record, period, it's out of the ordinary.
Exactly.
You know, because 99.99% of the competitors at these meets are not going to break a world record. So anytime you break it, period, it's out of the ordinary. But I think there's always the underlying tone of, it was done, what an unbelievable race, I can't believe what my eyes just saw.
Right.
You know, but I'm not going to be that quick. I think this sport has become much more of a global sport than it once was. And I think these, as long as you don't see it systematically, which we haven't, I don't think there's any reason to believe that they're systematic. Like it was in 94. I'm telling you, Nathan, you weren't there in 94. And some of the athletes some of the people that may be listening who were there in 1994 will tell you that it was scary how big these women were, how many of them there were, and how fast they were. I mean,
right. Well, and in her defense, Yi Shiwen wasn't even born in 1994.
Exactly. That's correct.
Right. It's just very interesting when you see so many similarities. And I don't think, particularly because at this juncture, we certainly have to look at her as a naturally talented, clean athlete. I just think it was unfortunate use of terms for her, because for those of us who remember and those of us who know the history of the Chinese team, particularly between 93 and 98, you don't want to put yourself in that, you know, in that area. You don't want to put yourself in that context. And by using the exact same term that was used back then, only to find out that when they used it then, they were all, you know, they're just a bunch of liars. It doesn't do her any good. You know, it certainly didn't help her cause to be seen as a clean champion.
Well, you have to go back and say, hey, was she saying that just because those were her personal beliefs? That's her thought. Maybe she's never even heard that was said before. there's a lot of questions that can be asked. Remember, there's a huge language barrier. You're talking about folks who don't speak Chinese. You're talking about Chinese who don't speak English. And there could be some things that are lost in translation. So I'm going to continue to give her the benefit of the doubt until she proves me wrong. Look, I hope she doesn't prove me wrong, because you know what's going to happen is she's raised the bar to a level that I think her world record can be broken. Remember, you know, when she finished that race, she looked unbelievable. But it wasn't one of those things where when she touched, everybody else was out of the picture. There were other athletes in the picture when she touched.
Yeah, and, you know, it's obviously that last 100 is one of those things that has become extremely, I guess you could say, kind of a big point of contention because of her last 50 being faster than Ryan Lochte's final 50. So she might be the one to bring it down a few notches. Certainly other people will have to step up. But, you know, that remains to be seen. I just a lot of flack came from those comments. Not just because of their eerie reminiscence to 1994, but also from the fact I think a lot of people from not just the United States, but a lot of countries, took offense to it. Who's to say that the Chinese actually train harder? Because there are a lot of programs around here and other countries outside of China where, yes, they feel like they train smart, but they also pour on the yardage. They pour in the hard work, the race sets, the lactate, the, you know, working your underwaters. I mean, there are athletes that I know who daily go out and put themselves on the line, get out of the pool completely spent because that's what they feel they need to do to be the best that they can possibly be. Who's to say that China trains harder than these? I don't buy it. I think that there are athletes around the world who train to 100% of their capacity, and it's naive for anybody to be able to just come out and say, well, we train harder. BS, you don't know that's the case. And anywhere in the world where you have athletes who want to be the best, you have athletes who are training as hard as possible.
Where did she train?
China, Australia, several places.
Who did she train under in Australia? That's one of those things that I look at is that coach, her coach is notorious for pounding his athletes.
But who's to say that that's harder than anyone
else?
There's coaches notorious in the U.S.
Right.
Who do the same
exactly. But in her mind, she might be thinking, look, you don't know how hard I trained. You don't know what I've done. And she's 16 years old. So let's put ourselves in her position for a second. She's a 16-year-old little girl who is saying, look, I earned every second of that race. I earned that world record. Who are you to think that you trained harder than me? I've trained harder than anybody.
How about this, Felipe?
No, listen, I'm not going to say it's eerily similar to what was said in 1994. I'm not going to say it, the same people are advising her that were advising the Chinese team in 1994. I actually remember watching a special on 2020 or one of the shows where it actually showed the Chinese women working out. And I'll never forget them doing lat pull downs and the Chinese guy saying, we work with 100, you work with 60. That's why we're stronger than you guys. I'm like, okay, that didn't make any sense. And that is ridiculous, but it could be putting it in the same light. But, you know, who knows?
Okay, well, answer this for me.
Yeah.
She spoke, as I read the quote, she was speaking of the Chinese team in general, saying the Chinese team works harder. If that's the case and that's why they work harder, and they work harder, the Chinese team as a whole, and that's why they're better, why did she have to go to Australia to train?
You know, great question.
Obviously she wasn't the only Chinese swimmer training in Australia, but there's just a couple of them. And if she's speaking for the Chinese team as a whole, and in her mind she believes that the Chinese as a whole train harder, then why in the world did she have to go to Australia? See, that's where there's a disconnect here.
Yeah. Well, again, I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on this one, just simply because, you know, I respect your point of view. I really do. And you know what? She won the 400 AM. She won it in a world record time. I'm not going to discount her swim like I wouldn't discount anybody else's who turned in a world record performance at the Olympics, which, by the way, there weren't many.
Well, sure. But this isn't, you know, we're beyond her performance. I think we've beat that horse to death. But now it's the same way that somebody getting an Olympic rings tattoo gets them in the news, or Lochte trademarking Jiao, or Phelps going to golf, whatever it is. These are news stories now. And now her comments about saying, well, we train harder, China trains harder, this is different. Okay, we buy her performance. That's fine. She's got the world record. She's the Olympic champion. And That's the fact until something, if something comes up and changes that. But now, when she wants to come out and say, well, China trains harder, well, you're training in Australia for one, and you can't really speak for the rest of the world because I'm sure, Felipe, you gave 100%. I'm sure that our listeners, most of them, when they go train, they give 100%. And I'm sure they're thinking the same thing. Well, who is she to say, yeah, she's an Olympic champion, but who is she to say that their country trains harder than our country?
That's that national pride, man. I mean, why don't we do a duel in the pool, U.S. versus China, just to get it all out of the way?
Let's get them involved in the duel. Yeah, we should. What's up with this U.S. versus Europe stuff? I mean, no offense, but team is a little more cohesive, and we keep winning it. So let's mix it up a little bit, huh?
Do the U.S. versus Pacific Rim. At this point, I think they could hold their own. You know, with Australia, if you throw Australia, New Zealand in there, you throw, you know, the Asian countries in there. Why not? Just do it.
I think it's good. I think it would be good.
Hell, U.S. versus the world. I mean, they already obliterated the world. Let's do it again.
Yeah, I think the issue that we run into on those duel in the pools, while I certainly enjoy the production value of them, I think the issue you run into is USA Swimming is a cohesive unit. Trying to get a world team together, like we saw last time around, you know, certain swimmers didn't want to participate or couldn't participate, and it really made the other squad suffer. And I honestly, while we know that in the Olympic Games show it, that the U.S. is the strongest swimming nation, I just don't feel like we're really displaying that when we win the duel in the pool, simply for the fact that we're not going against the best that the rest of the world has to offer.
Right.
But even if we were, look at the medal count from the Olympic Games. Everyone's bringing their A game there. With the duel in the pool, every time we hear about, well, so-and-so wasn't tapered or so-and-so is injured, but they're still swimming, that kind of thing. Everyone brings their A game to the Olympic Games, and we still win. What's the point of the duel?
You know, I think we need to do a production, man. I think, honest to God, I think it needs to be like WWE style. Like big production. I think the swimmers should come down a ramp with like capes on and like a mask. And, you know, every swimmer should, you know, create an alter ego. I think that would make it so much more fun, you know. And then they get up and race.
Clearly, Felipe is starting to drink in the middle of the show.
I'll have another, please. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on that note, we're running out of time anyway. So maybe we'll discuss Felipe's WWE desire for USA Swimming at a later date.
I'm sure they'll be all for it.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, Felipe, appreciate your time as always, your comments. Well, I'm sure some of this stuff is going to be coming back up, and we'll see if Lochte trademarks Jet and it becomes the next Armani or Dolce & Gabbana or whatever the big brand that it becomes. Well, I'm sure we'll be the first ones on here to admit that we were wrong. He's brilliant, and you know, he's a multi-billionaire, and who knows, maybe he'll be the one who finances the you know, the big WWE style swimming league. We'll see.
I like what you're thinking. I like where you're going with this.
All right. Well, Felipe, thanks a lot. We are going to move on now to our swim off one-on-one interview with Chloe Sutton. This is part one of my sit down with Chloe. Joining me on the swim off one-on-one interview now is a good friend and two-time Olympian just back from London, Chloe Sutton. Chloe, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
All right, Chloe, we've got lots to talk about because you've been in some pretty unique situations. The first ever American Open Water Olympian in 2008 in Beijing, competing there. And 2012, transitioned to the pool to compete in London. So we've got a lot to talk about because I think you're in a pretty unique position to answer some questions that our listeners might have had over the years. So I want to go back, and we'll do this a little in a chronological order. So let's start 2008. You made the Olympic team. So young, first Olympic team. What did that feel like?
It was amazing. I mean, it was just a dream come true. I mean, I'm sure for so many people they can relate, you know, to just having a dream your whole life and finally being able to achieve it. And I was surprised to be able to achieve it at such a young age, but, you know, it's all I had ever wanted since I first started swimming, and I was so proud to be able to fulfill my dreams.
And what did it feel like to know that you were the first? There was no precedent. It hadn't happened before. You were breaking new ground, and for the rest of your life, for the history of the sport, you are going to be the first Olympian that our country, the greatest swimming country in the world, the first open water Olympian ever. Did that resonate with you at the time, or is that something that you more look back on now and think, wow, that's pretty cool?
I don't think I really realized it at the time. I didn't really think about, I guess, being the first person to, I didn't really think about how new it was, but I guess it might have been a little bit scary because I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what it was going to be like. Nobody had any feedback for me or anything to tell me about what it might have been like ever, so it was a little scary and a little just, I didn't know what was going on, but I think I was so young, I didn't really think about it much. I was just kind of going through the motions and doing whatever everybody else.
You didn't
else
think that one
do.
Day maybe, you know, you're going to be a Jeopardy question now.
That would be awesome. I don't know about that, but yeah, well, I guess now looking back, it's cool to be able to say that, and it's something that nobody else can really ever do, so. It's special to be able to say that, and I'm very blessed.
Well, we've had at least two swimmers, Megan Gendrick and Rowdy Gaines, have been Jeopardy questions, so I totally see, who the first ever open water Olympian for the United States, and the answer will be, who is Chloe Sutton? I can see it coming. It's on the way. Don't you worry. Well, when one of our listeners who watches that show sees that, make sure that you call or write in so we can talk about that. But so 2008, first time Olympian, first Olympian in the sport. At that point, obviously you're experiencing tremendous success, not just making that Olympic team, but leading into it in open water. It's safe to say, without argument, you're the face of the sport. At that point, though, was there any part of you that was thinking, you know what, maybe I should take this to the pool?
Well, I was a pool swimmer before I started open water. I still swam in every nationals, and I swam in the pool all throughout my open water career, so I never stopped being a pool swimmer. I just did open water as well. So, I never really thought about stopping doing open water, but, when my heart told me that I just didn't want to do it anymore and it just wasn't right for me, I'm going to listen to it because, this sport, it's all about just doing what you love and being happy and having fun with it. And once it stopped being super fun for me and once I decided to switch over to the pool, I knew it was the right thing to do.
So I think that's something that you're touching on here that I haven't read you discussing before. But you talk about not being in love with the sport of open water swimming anymore. Was there anything specific that brought that about with you? Or was it just something that you felt you had done so long and had enough success with? Like, what was it that had you fall out of love with open water and decide to focus on the pool?
There was a lot of factors that went into it. It wasn't just one thing. I mean, there were so many things that just started making it less fun for me. And also, I think a lot of people can also relate, as you grow older, when I was younger, I just went out there. I didn't think about anything. I just swam and I just raced and I had fun with it. And then it started, I started having expectations on me and it started getting a little scary. And then I started thinking about what I was actually doing, swimming in the ocean, I guess kind of how dangerous it is, I started getting scared for my races, not just nervous, but scared for them. And once I started realizing I was scared to race, I knew it was time to stop.
Now, I think something that a lot of people have probably wondered is just adapting to the sport that's so violent in general, because I think anyone who's met you comes away thinking, oh my gosh, Chloe is so nice, she's so sweet, she's a darling. Like, how did you find, especially when you are half the age of some of the girls that you are competing with that are literally, they're trying to kick your butt in there. I mean, how did you really find your niche when you're such a sweet person in a sport that not a race goes by without people elbowing, kicking, all that kind of stuff?
Well, I have a giant football playing brother that I'm so proud of, and it's fun to be able to take swings at him all the time and he can't hit me back. But I guess I probably learned a lot of that from him and our days just, when we were younger, wrestling and stuff.
So you had a lot of practice from transitioning into, butt kicking mode when you needed
it. Yeah, I always used to say I was helping Colin prepare for football, but he was actually preparing me for open water. But at the beginning I was just so surprised when people would try to take swings at me or, do things. I was like, that's not very nice, and I try to kind of like swipe at them underwater, but obviously not making any real contact, just kind of making myself feel better. But, you know, I learned as I went, you know, different moves to just stay away from people and protect myself and, you know, retaliate when I needed to, just to make sure that I stood my ground and let people know I couldn't be messed with. And, you know, I was able to figure it out, even though I'm definitely not a violent or angry person by any means.
Do you think that before we start talking about the pool stuff and trials in 2012 and leading into that, let's one more question about Martin. Do you think that it's something that you will return to in your competitive future?
I don't really know. You know, my best friend is Ashley Twitchell, so she's, you know, a prominent open water swimmer, almost made the Olympic team. And, you know, if I had the opportunity to go travel somewhere really cool with her and just swim an open water race while we're there, I probably would. But I don't know about being super serious about it again. But then again, you know, I never thought I would stop doing open water, so I'm just gonna do whatever I want, you know. This is the great thing about our sport, is you just do whatever makes you happy, you know. And as long as I keep staying on top and, you know, earning enough money to continue it, I can keep doing it. So you know, whatever makes me happy. If I decide to go back, it would be fun. I loved it for so long and had so much fun doing it. But right now, my plan is in the pool and training for 2016. I'm very serious about that.
Well, certainly crossover success has happened. You going from the Olympic team in Beijing in open water to London in 2012 in the pool. And of course, we've seen like Os Mululi decide he wanted to give open water a go, and that turned out pretty well for him with a gold medal in London. So
that
certainly,
pretty good,
yeah, certainly the crossover success can be had. Now, let's talk about getting into the pool, leading into 2012. Obviously, the preparation for an event where you're not getting punched and don't have to kick back at people has to be a little different than the open water. So can you tell us a little bit about your preparation leading into trials in 2012 as compared to what you were doing to train for Beijing?
There was quite a bit of differences. You know, I used to do 100K weeks where we do 10K every practice for 10 practices. so that was, you know, not as enjoyable as, you know, I don't know if you guys think it would be enjoyable, but yeah, there were some changes. But, you know, since I stopped doing open water at the very end of 2010, there wasn't much time to make any drastic changes. You know, 10K to a 400 or an 800 is a drastic drop of distance. So, you know, we kind of thought, well, it's worked for me in the past. You know, in 2010, I won the gold medal at Pan Pacs in the 400. You know, it's worked for me, so why would we really need to change my training much? And, you know, a year and a half before the Olympics wasn't really much time to play with it or try something new. You know, we didn't really want to risk that. So, you know, we just kind of kept with doing something similar, and I didn't do any crazy 100K weeks or anything, but I didn't change much. I still trained pretty much like a distance, you know, long distance swimmer, like a 10K swimmer. You know, we had a lot of really long practices, and we worked on my endurance a lot. I did have my speed days. I did do a lot of work on trying to get a lot of speed, and I think that is why I made the Olympic team. Coach Rose being able to throw a few of those days in, but you know, we didn't get to play with it much. Now I have 4 years, and I can play with my training a lot, and I can work on my going out speed and figuring out how to sprint, because that's something I never really knew how to do. I just knew I had endurance, and you know, I did whatever I could to get on that team in the 400, and you know, I wanted the 800, but that didn't work out. But now I have time to play with it, so I'm planning on changing my training. Not a ton, you know. I don't want to take away from who I am, but I want to work on being able to tag races more. That's my main goal.
Now let's talk a little bit about mindset leading into trials. A lot of people say if they've been to a trials before, the next one's not nearly as daunting and they have more confidence. And for those who have made the Olympic team, they say coming back and trying to make another one isn't quite the same challenge, at least on the mental level, as it was the first time around. Now you obviously are in a unique position because, yes, you are an Olympian, but it was in what's really, it's a different sport. Yes, they use the same medium, water, but it's a different sport. So how was that for you? Did you have more confidence about the potential of making the Olympic team in 2012 because you were an Olympian, or did that really not factor in because it was a different sport?
Well, 2008 was a unique situation for me. I was able to go to Olympic trials in the pool. I came in third in the 800 there, so I was still, you know, swimming in the pool at the time, but I'd already made the Olympic team. I know, I was going to the trials just to enjoy the experience, just for fun. And so I had a really unique outlook on it. You know, I had already made the team. I was already an Olympian. I just went to the Olympics as kind of a pit stop before I went to the Olympics. And that was really, really neat to be able to experience that way, because I was able to take it all in and really enjoy it. But I don't think, up until recently, I don't really think I took swimming all that. I mean, I trained extremely hard and I took it seriously, but I didn't really grasp the gravity of it and what it really meant to me. And now that it's like my job, I think going into trials, about a month out, I was going up to my mom crying because I was just so scared. And, you know, then, you know, after, you know, she talked me off the ledge, basically, because I was just freaking out. I'm like, oh my gosh, Olympic trials is a month away. How am I going to do this? How am I going to be ready for this? But, you know, Coach Rose got me ready, and he started training me, and, or, you know, he started tapering me and getting me ready, and, you know, I was really able to start feeling ready. And I started thinking to myself, you know what, I can do this. I'm ready for this. This is my time. You know, I can't be afraid of this. I have to just jump into it. You know, I'm not going to have any choice. I'm not going to be able to push it off at all. So, you know, it was, this trials was a lot more stressful for me. I mean, like, a million times more stressful. And I think Olympic trials is stressful for a lot of people. You know, so many ups and downs and just crazy emotions, and seeing all your friends make the team or seeing all your friends not make the team is just, it's like you age like 10 years during the whole experience. But, you know, I still enjoyed it. And being able to make the team on day two was great, so I could, you know, enjoy the rest of trials. But, I mean, it's just...
Well, on that sense, you talk about making it on day two. Now, we had talked before years ago on that other program that I hosted. We chatted, and I remember you saying that the longer the race, the better you do. So, did you have a higher expectation for the 800 than the 400?
I did. I definitely did. I was like, oh, wow, if I went that fast in my 400, think about how fast I'll go in my 800. And, but, you know, I think, you know, Coach Rose is still kind of trying to figure out my taper, you know, being only a pool swimmer for a year and a half, or, you know, I've been doing pool swimming all along, but focusing on pool for not very long. And I think we're still trying to figure it out. He did an amazing job getting me ready for that 400. I think maybe because that was my first race, and that was the one that I was scared for. That was the one that I was really nervous for, because I don't think I'm, you know, I thought I was better at the 800. I was so nervous for the 400. I think I maybe prepared for it more or kind of focused on it more, and that's what kind of took a lot of my energy. And, you know, I was surprised about my 800 and how awful I felt as soon as I dove in the water. And, you know, I can kind of look at the rest of my team, and they had similar experiences. A lot of us did really well in the 400, not so great in the 800. You know, some of our guys didn't do as great in the mile as they were hoping, but they did well at the beginning of the meet. So I don't know if it was a taper issue or if it was just, you know, where I put my energy because of my own insecurities. But yeah, I was surprised not to make the 800 and really disappointed in that. I was frustrated, you know, because...
Well, before we talk about the low, let's talk about the high. If you didn't expect so much to do as much or as well in the 400, when you touched that wall and you turned around and you saw second and you knew that you were, your ticket was booked, you were there, what did that feel like? I mean, we know that you're an emotional swimmer, and I think that's what's really endearing about you to a lot of fans, is you're not afraid of your emotions. You'll show them, you'll talk about them, and that makes you so personable. So when you touched that wall... And you saw that, and you saw that scoreboard, and two, it may as well have read, you're going to London. How did that feel?
Well, I don't know if my emotions, you know, and me being so emotional is really a choice. That's something I can't control much. I break out into tears more than I should, but I try not to as much as possible, because, you know, I don't want people to see it as a weakness. I'm just so passionate about swimming. But I kind of knew, you know, you can see where you are in the race. When I started feeling myself gain on Katie Ledecky, I started feeling, oh my gosh, I could do this. I could do this. And then, you know, when I touched the wall and looked back, it was, and I think a lot of other Olympians can relate to this, it was more relief than excitement. You know, it was more just like, thank goodness, I finally, after all these years, you know, it's like, thank gosh, you know, if it wouldn't have happened, it would have been so much devastation. But when it did happen, it doesn't quite correlate, you know, to the amount of low that you would have if you didn't make it, to the amount of high that you would think you would have. But it was more relief to me, and but that's still an amazing feeling. And then being able to see my parents and my friends and how happy they were for me, it's you're on cloud nine, and it's hard to climb down from there.
So you made the team in the 400 at probably, again, we talked about your expectations for the 800, really feeling like that was going to be your better one. You felt if you could go as fast as you did in the 400, the 800 was really going to turn out well. When you touched the wall at the end of the 800, what was the first thing that went through your mind when you saw the scoreboard there?
I mean, just emptiness, disappointment. I kind of knew, you know in your races, usually if you feel crappy, it's going to be a crappy time. So, I kind of was swimming a race and I was like, oh my gosh, this hurts so much. What's going on? I feel so sluggish, so tired, and trying to be like, don't say that to yourself, push it, you can do this, you can still pull this out, but sometimes your body just screams no at you. And then touching the wall and looking back, I was just so disappointed. But
was there at least a sense of, I don't want to say that it was like a backup, but I mean, surely you had to look at it and be like, hey, I'm still going to London, right? I mean, did that cross your mind while you were trying to cope with not being happy with your race?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been brought up to be grateful for what I have, even if it's not exactly what I want. So, that did cross my mind, quote-unquote, breakdown afterwards, after a disappointing race, when I finally get back to my hotel room and have a chance to, wallow a little bit and have my little 5-minute pity party that I allow myself. It probably wasn't as bad as if I would have just completely missed making the team, but as an athlete, and I keep saying this, I know so many people can relate, you're never like really satisfied, and you have such high expectations on yourself, and when you don't reach them, it's so frustrating and you're so angry about it. I wish a lot of things could have gone differently, but again, I'm so grateful for the opportunity to compete and go to London and have that whole experience, be able to call myself a 2-time Olympian. I mean, there are so many things that I'm grateful for. I shouldn't ever complain.
Now let's talk about, we've covered trials now. Like I said, we want to try to keep this a little chronological. So before we start talking about London themselves, media-wise, and I think this was largely aided by the fact that you all could tweet and Facebook, and it's even so much more popular now than it was in Beijing, this team, at least to the eyes of the public, seemed like it was really one cohesive unit. It seemed like the team that you were able to be a part of for London was really special. So let's talk a little bit about that. When you got together as a team in the end, what was your perspective, having been on two teams, when you look at the 2012 team, did it seem decidedly different to you than 2008? Did it feel like you were going to experience as a whole a greater level of success, or was it just one of those things like, hey, this is the Olympic team, we're going to be good? Or did you feel that there was something special?
I did, for sure. And I don't know exactly what it was, but when we all got together as a group, it just felt better. It just felt more positive. It felt like there was an aura of just an elevated level of everything. When you sat together in a group, and in 2008, we just seemed like a group of people thrown together, a group of Olympic, a group of Olympians on a team together competing, or a group of swimmers. But 2008 felt like a team, 2012 felt like a team. It felt like we were all in it together, and our whole collective attitude was so positive and happy, and everybody was just so carefree and having fun and training super hard, really focused, but silly and happy and fun. And you can see that in the Call Me Maybe video. It totally epitomizes the whole trip.
Now tell us about that. Let's talk about it. It's got millions of views. All the major media outlets picked it up. It really kind of gave people a look into the U.S. swim team, which I don't think it's something you'd never see that with U.S. track. You'd never see that with any other sport. But here comes the U.S. swim team with a Call Me Maybe video. There's so many things that could be said about that song, and I won't say any of them. Other than you guys did your thing on it. Tell us about, how did that come about, and how did it feel to be a part? And when it got picked up everywhere, and when it crossed 1 million views, and 2 million views, now 3 million views, how did that feel? What did that do to your cohesion as a team, having done something that became so popular, and it wasn't even in the pool?
Yeah, I mean, it was just so natural. It was so genuine. And that is exactly what our team felt like. We just felt like a bunch of goofy kids together doing what we love, you know, just having fun at the pool. You know, obviously we train hard, we're really focused and we're dedicated, but as soon as practice is over, or even sometimes, you know, during practice, we're all happy. We were happy, and we were just all, that video was filmed while we were in Vichy, France, and it was so beautiful there, and we were all just, I think we were all so grateful to be there and be a part of everything and just so happy and excited. You know, we're right, it was right before we were competing in the Olympic Games. We had so much to be happy for that we were like, hey, wouldn't it be kind of fun if we just, like, threw together a video, like, have you seen those Call Me Maybe compilation videos? That would be so fun to do.
Now, how many of you actually like that song?
I mean, every time I say, that's crazy, I'm like, hey, I just met you. And it keeps stuck in my head so much now, just because we had it playing pretty much that whole trip. Because we just, you know, a bunch of the girls and some of the guys were just carrying around cameras. And every time, you know, somebody had their camera out, they were having Call Me Maybe play on their phone and just seeing what people would do to it, you know? It was just like, I watched that video and that's something that I will always be able to go back and watch and remember. That's how it felt. It's, you know, even though Call Me Maybe might not be, like, the best song to really describe the Olympic team, you know, it's...
Well, I can say y'all made me go so back on a... Y'all made me go back on a promise I made myself. The first time I heard that song, I told myself, I'm never listening to this again. And then, sure enough, here comes the U.S. team and do a parody. And, of course, I had to watch that, and I've watched it a couple times now. But
it was just so fun. We loved every minute of making that video. And then, you know, I'm going to go back and watch that video anytime I'm feeling down, because it just makes you happy about everything that is in that video and the idea that it represents. Just, you know, a bunch of kids swimming and doing what they love.
That was our show. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you as always for tuning in. We hope that you'll be back with us next week for another episode of Off the Wall on Swimming World Radio.